Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're getting more clear signals from the Trump White House on at least some of the approaches to replacing Obamacare. New rules were issued last week by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, some of which will change the consumer experience considerably.
According to a press release from CMS, these changes are aimed at stabilizing the individual and small group insurance markets, where more than 20 million Americans now access their insurance coverage. One big change, the Trump administration is calling for much shorter enrollment periods, starting with the next open enrollment.
The new rule would cut in half the open enrollment period to just 6 weeks from the previous 3 months. That could significantly impact the number of people who are able to sign up for coverage, because as we know from experience, many people wait to the last moment to sign up.
And there's another significant departure from the health law coming from the new administration, and that is lowering the minimum standards for care for the plans to qualify for the exchanges. The Affordable Care Act established very clear minimum standards for comprehensive coverage in order to be certified as a bronze, a silver, or a gold level. The new rule allows insurers to cover fewer areas of health care and still be at a certain metal level, if you will, meaning consumers would be gaining less coverage while likely paying more for their care.
Dr. Patrick Conway, the acting CMS administrator and former guest on this show, said the proposal will take steps to stabilizing the marketplace, provide more flexibility to states and insurers, while giving patients access to more coverage options, especially during the uncertain period when replacement of the health law is still being debated politically.
Mm-hmm. But a number of health industry advocates warned this is going to lead to far more out-of-pocket expenses for consumers and, at the same time, get less comprehensive coverage for what they're purchasing. So just proposals at this point, Mark, the new rules up for public discussion in March.
Meanwhile, Margaret, state Medicaid directors across the country are seeking clarity as they prepare for the 2018 enrollments and are seeking to have assurances that they will be able to continue to serve their vulnerable populations, many of whom gain coverage under the Medicaid expansion. Dr. Jennifer Walthall is the Secretary of the Indiana Family and Social Service Administration, a state that launched its own successful version of Medicaid expansion and has requested that CMS continue support for their program, which expanded coverage to 350,000 Hoosiers.
This is a plan that was launched under former Governor Mike Pence, now, of course, the vice president. It took a slightly different approach to the Medicaid expansion. It required recipients to have, quote unquote, more skin in the game in terms of their financial responsibility. I'm really interested to hear how the Indiana plan worked and what other states might learn from their experience.
Laurie Robertson also stops by. The managing editor of factcheck.org is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Jennifer Walthall in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Not a terribly good run for health insurance mergers, especially of the enormous kind. The proposed $54 billion merger between insurance carriers Anthem and the smaller Cigna Corporation was blocked by an antitrust judge, a deal that would have created the world's largest health insurer. Anthem is appealing the deal and has also filed a lawsuit suing Cigna for a little under $2 billion if it backs out of the merger. Cigna countersuing Anthem, saying the larger carrier didn't do enough to eliminate anti-competitive elements of their business and is seeking $13 billion in damages for shareholders. Meanwhile, in a separate case, another proposed merger between Aetna and Humana was similarly blocked by an antitrust judge. Federal judges struck down both deals as anti-competitive at the request of the Justice Department. Aetna and Humana said on Tuesday they would not further pursue their deal. In the meantime, Humana announced it would no longer offer health insurance coverage in the state marketplaces created under the federal health care law, becoming the first major insurer to cast a no-confidence vote over selling individual plans on the public exchanges for next year. And the Trump administration did make some moves to dismantle the health care law, issuing new rules from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that would significantly shorten the open enrollment period for the marketplaces and would also reduce the number of required benefits on the exchange plans. Aetna CEO Mark Bertolini says he believes the online insurance marketplaces are in, quote, a death spiral. Another reason to kick the habit, a study shows that current smokers diagnosed with colon cancer are more likely to die from the disease than former smokers or non-smokers. Researchers examined five-year survival odds for 18,000 people diagnosed with colorectal cancer and found current smokers were 14% more likely to die during the study period than people who never smoked. The effect was seen mainly among smokers treated with surgery but no chemotherapy. That group had a 21% higher mortality rate. The study wasn't a controlled experiment designed to prove smoking causes colorectal cancer or deaths from the disease. Researchers don't have data on how many patients smoked after diagnosis as well. Other lifestyle factors may influence survival on how long patients live. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Jennifer Walthall, Secretary of the Indiana Family and Social Service Administration. She recently served as Deputy State Health Commissioner and Director of Health Outcomes for the Indiana State Department of Health. Dr. Walthall is currently an Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine and Pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine. She earned her undergraduate degree from the University of Houston's Honors College and her Master's in Public Health at Indiana University. She earned her medical degree at Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Walthall, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
You know, everybody in the country knows that there's a change afoot, a new approach to health reform under the Trump administration. And you had a very unique perch, Indiana, certainly front and center now on the transformation that it went through in its Medicaid program, serving under Vice President Pence while he was governor of Indiana. You witnessed Indiana's unique approach to the Medicaid expansion developed by the newly confirmed administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Seema Verma. While a number of Republican-led states balked at the ACA, Indiana actually forged a different pathway, covering more uninsured residents living closer to poverty. I wonder if you could share with our listeners what was unique about the Healthy Indiana program and why you think it works so well.
Well, the Healthy Indiana Plan actually predated Medicaid expansion. They now are doing what I like to think of simplistically as training wheels on a bike. Mm-hmm. The goal of many of the social services we provide here at FSSA is to promote the achievement of health and success through independence. This model is built on the theory that we can be partners with people to navigate their way into the commercial health access market through engagement and support. But that's takes a little bit of time, and it takes some training, and it takes a lot of effort together as partners. It's admittedly not perfect. The bottom of my email has the graphic with our motto for the state, which is a state that works. Hmm. And in order to achieve that goal, we have to support and build infrastructure for a healthy workforce. And that's the goal that we have as we move forward. And we think that HIP can continue to play a part in that. HIP is described as a consumer-directed approach to health coverage that actually replaces traditional Medicaid in Indiana for all non-disabled Hoosiers ages 19 to 64. So a population really that predominantly has not had access to healthcare in the past. And it builds on the successes of our original HIP design, which is now in its 10th year of operation. And it's referred to as consumer-directed because the basic and routine costs of healthcare are paid by the patient-managed account versus the insurance company. And this is to promote consumer behavior by giving patients greater control over their own health budgets and the health care that they receive. And there are several factors that led to the early successes that we've seen of the Healthy Indiana Plan. The fact that it was built on the foundation of this existing program helped. But another key to the success of the program is that HIP is structured so that it pays doctors more to care for members. So instead of reimbursing doctors at Medicaid rates, HIP 2.0 pays Medicare rates, which are significantly higher. And this has helped recruit over 6,000 new healthcare providers into the Medicaid network, which has increased access to care for our members. And our approach has been from the beginning that it was insufficient to simply provide coverage without making policy changes that would also improve access.
Well, Dr. Watha, one of the pieces of data that we know from research around the country is that increasing coverage to the uninsured improves population health and health outcome metrics. And I think that's been pretty well shown. Now, Indiana's expansion increased coverage, as I understand, to 350,000 previously uninsured residents. And certainly many states have struggled to then balance demand with capacity on the clinical side. And one of the things that seems to have helped around the country in the first years, anyway, after the ACA passed was the bump that states got to pay closer to the Medicare rates for primary care. But I'm also curious about the role that other organizations like community health centers may have played in helping to fill that primary care gap with so many newly uninsured residents. And as you know, the longer people were out of care, the more likely they had pent-up demand.
You bet. We've seen an incredible surge of partnerships around the primary care space, both from community health centers and also from bringing in a primary care workforce. And one of the things that I've been very excited to be part of is the governor's health workforce commission really filling those primary care deserts for the state so that as we improve access to health care coverage, we improve access to health care in general and management of chronic diseases. In HIP in particular, about 87% of our HIP Plus members used preventive health services during their first year of enrollment. So that's a pretty big deal.
Absolutely.
In my mind.
Yep.
That we're seeing people really engage, and that's hear that word over and over again is engagement. And so, about 75% overall of HIP members that were enrolled for the whole year received preventive care services, and that's a good number when you think about where and how those services might have been received before.
Well, your former governor has gotten a promotion. He's vice president.
He did.
And you now have a new governor, Eric Holcomb, who's probably found himself in a little interesting situation. And the vice president, of course, is focused in on repealing the Affordable Care Act. Governor Holcomb has written to the federal government, imploring them to continue funding the Medicaid expansion. But we're hearing a lot of talk about shifting Medicaid to a block grant system. What is the best way forward in this transition period, and what do you expect is likely to happen?
Well, I'll tell you, I was appointed to this role as FSSA secretary on January 9th and was very excited on January 31st to be part of the team that submitted the additional HIP 2.0 waiver application with Governor Holcomb. So here in Indiana, we're working with our program and proposing the next iteration of HIP, which is even better than what we have now. We believe that the Healthy Indiana Plan has given us the ability to think about how a state program can succeed when it's given the flexibility to meet the needs of the state in a fiscally responsible way. And we believe that federal reform should give states more flexibility to design programs that work. And two examples of this flexibility in our relationship with the federal government is that we think that the federal government should expeditiously approve waivers that are substantially similar to waivers approved in other states and provide a path to permanency that allows waiver policies to become permanent features of the program after being approved twice and demonstrating proven results. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Watha, you know, we followed the crisis that you all found yourself in. I think this was back when you were deputy state health commissioner, with the spike in the opioid epidemic and the significant spike in the number of HIV and hepatitis C cases. We know that you were very involved in responding to the crisis and developed an innovative kind of triage approach to tackling the outbreak. Could you share with our listeners a little bit about that crisis? What might public health officials and communities in other states learn from your experience?
The HIV, hepatitis C, and opiate outbreak response in Scott County really has informed the way that we are moving forward with the ongoing opiate epidemic. To be part of that response has been one of the most profound and humbling and rewarding experiences of my professional career. And truly, the most important change is the way that we frame our efforts, which is welcoming Hoosiers back into a place of hope. The HIV outbreak and its roots in the opiate crisis are a clarion call for economic development, education, and connectivity in our communities. And to this end, our governor now has a director in his office to oversee this work so that our state agencies and stakeholders can collectively build on this response. Dr. Adams, our health commissioner, and I often reference a young man who told us early on in the response that HIV saved his life. The access to health coverage and all of the resources that opened to him truly mm-hmm. did save his life. The concurrence of HIP 2.0 going live and the HIV outbreak in Scott mm-hmm. County were pivotal to its success. And our hope is that the roadmap of emergency needs, capacity building, and prevention programming will be sustainable and effective. And I'll give you an example of each of those. Emergency tools include widely available and unrestricted naloxone use and local control of syringe exchange programs. Capacity building includes recruitment and retention of the mental health workforce at all levels, training of primary care providers in substance use disorder treatments, including medication-assisted therapy, and immediate connection of patients to services at their moment of need. And three is the big one, which is prevention. And prevention really is all about infrastructure and education. It's about thoughtful provider rules around acute and chronic narcotic prescribing. All of these also need data, and we're really excited about Indiana's unique data capability through what we call the Management Performance Hub, which connects data across all state agencies to move toward both predictive analytics and also true implementation science and analysis of the outcomes effectiveness of our efforts.
We're speaking today with Dr. Jennifer Walthall, Secretary of the Indiana Family and Social Service Administration. She also served as Deputy State Health Commissioner and Director of Health Outcomes for the Indiana State Department of Health. One of the main reasons Indiana's Governor Holcomb is seeking support for the Medicaid expansion model is expressly because it will help state officials continue to battle this epidemic. I wonder if you could share with our listeners how the program resources are going to be used, and again, what might other state officials learn from the Indiana experience?
So this particular component of the HIP 2.0 waiver seeks to fill treatment gaps by adding new services that will include residential treatment. The new benefits will include expanded inpatient detox services, residential treatment services, and addiction recovery support services. And those include peer recovery support services, housing support services, recovery-focused case management, and relapse prevention services. The waiver of IMD, which is the Institution for Mental Disease, is a medical facility of more than 16 beds. And currently, we are only able to reimburse for a 15-day stay in these types of facilities through managed care programs. But this waiver would allow Medicaid some total to reimburse for short-term services of up to 30 days. And what that would do is expand access to nearly 15 new facilities and have increased capacity at 12 others, which fills a huge treatment gap that we're seeing and feeling right now. And two things I really have to mention, important populations to remember, and those are pregnant women and those who are incarcerated. And so the expansion of services for pregnant women through continuation of HIP is near and dear to my heart. We've seen the opiate epidemic manifest itself through neonatal abstinence syndrome, and making sure that we're supporting Indiana's pregnant women through these services, through delivery to safely stay connected and deliver healthy babies is important. Mm-hmm. Additionally, we are able to now start signing folks who are incarcerated up for healthcare coverage so that they don't have a gap when they are released back into the community. And so this has been a great move for us to be able to improve health outcomes mm-hmm. in this vulnerable population as well.
Well, Dr. Walthall, I was so glad to hear your reference before the focus on the provider community overcoming provider deserts in healthcare. And you yourself are an educator. You've been professor of pediatrics at the Indiana University School of Medicine. And I am really curious how your work in the public sector and in public health has informed your approach to training the next generation of healthcare professionals.
As a brand new faculty, I had a simple observation. I'm a pediatric emergency mm-hmm. medicine provider, and we have a large residency program here in Indianapolis. And it was a simple observation as a teacher that our emergency medicine residents were quickly becoming very jaded and almost predictably burned out at a point in their residency and way too early in their training by the bombardment of seeing one patient at a time and never seeing that there was an end mm-hmm. to what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And it was my hope that somehow we could both train providers how to provide extraordinary care at the bedside, but also use those patient encounters as a lens to the more global problems in healthcare that each of those patients uh-huh. represented, uh-huh. and that the resident could then connect to not only the patient, but then also the community. And so this really would require a whole new layer of training. And in 2006, I started a program called the Emergency Medicine Advocacy Project. And there were three layers to this program: community outreach, systems improvement, and health policy. And It was through this very simple observation that really the whole way that we deliver our residency care training has transformed. It's now its own beast, has almost all of the residents as a member, multiple faculty members who engage. I actually had to go back to school to get my master's in public health to keep up with everything because they're smarter than I am.
Yep, yep.
And all three of these layers have really changed the way that we think about training. We think about, okay, not just am I going to give you the right medicines, but can you read and understand the instructions that are part of that medication? Do you have the transportation options to get to the specialty provider that I think that you need to see? Do you have a telephone that I can call and make sure that you're doing okay tomorrow? Are you going back into a healthy environment where your asthma education is actually going to make a difference? And these are the kind of providers that I don't have anything to do with how amazing they are. I just am a little gentle guide behind them. But this particular project has turned out some folks who are doing really incredible work across the country. As health services researchers, as global medicine academic experts. And so I think going back to the old adage of, for providers that you're either at the table or on the table, mm-hmm. Really is a call to arms for all of us to be the voice for the voiceless in our communities and makes us understand the power of being part of a solution mm-hmm. that is bigger than ourselves. And I think that alone helps our trainees understand their point mm-hmm. of being a part of this impressive and powerful movement to provide health to our country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to pick up on that phrase, solutions bigger than ourselves, and talk a little bit about the ongoing discussions that are going on in Washington about repealing, and increasingly we're hearing the word repairing the Affordable Care Act. Seema Verma is the Trump administration's choice for administrator for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And you've seen her brand of innovation at work in Indiana, and I would assume will be brought to the broader context of CMS. But what are your thoughts about how the powers to be in Washington should approach this dismantling of the health care law so that access and care isn't hampered at the state level? And how do you envision a way forward that will ensure continued advancement in population health?
Well, we certainly think that federal reform should be approached very thoughtfully and with recognition that states are all in different places with Medicaid expansion. And consideration should be given to states that choose to expand coverage for their citizens with the promise of a certain level of federal funding to support that. We are excited about the idea of allowing state flexibility. We think that we have the capacity to deliver these programs effectively, efficiently, and in an innovative way that works for our state population. Mm-hmm. And I think that every decision that we make should be about balance. And I would encourage everyone in this space, and as we have these conversations that are difficult and important, to think about a couple of things. And the first is always keeping in mind the lens of health equity. Will the decisions that we make widen outcomes gaps? Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that we're thinking about the most vulnerable of our population because we got into some health outcomes issues because we didn't. And so health equity really has to be the beginning and the end of our conversations around policy. And then also, if we decrease or change funding for healthcare proper, we need to look at also at the same time, how are we funding prevention and public health? Mm-hmm. So thinking about those two things, not as separate issues, but as one and the same. So where does public health and prevention funding fit into this picture, I think is important as we move forward.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Jennifer Walthall, Secretary of the Indiana Family and Social Services Administration. You can learn more about her work by going to in.gov/FSSA or follow her on Twitter at ConfectionsMD. Dr. Walthall, we want to thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Senator Ted Cruz claimed, quote, "Obamacare is discouraging people from going to medical school and training to be doctors." Actually, medical school applicants and enrollees are at an all-time high. Atul Grover, executive vice president at the Association of American Medical Colleges, told us the group hasn't seen any indication of declining interest in medicine since the Affordable Care Act was enacted. He said there are many more qualified applicants than room at the nation's medical schools. Total medical school enrollment has increased every year since President Obama signed the ACA into law. There are 88,304 students enrolled in medical school this school year. That's up from 77,371 in 2009-2010, a 14% increase. That's according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. The senator's office pointed us to a 2015 report prepared for the AAMC that said the U.S. is facing a 90,000 shortfall in doctors by 2025. Cruz's spokesperson argued the healthcare law has increased the demand for more physicians, but interest in medical schools has not kept up with the demand. But the AAMC says the primary cause of the doctor shortfall is an aging population, and the shortfall projection has been revised downward. It was more than 130,000 doctors in 2010. The reason the shortfall has grown smaller in recent years is that the number of physicians completing med school has gone up. To address the doctor shortage, the AAMC in 2006 set a goal of increasing first-year medical school enrollment by 30% by 2015-2016, up from the 2002-2003 level. That was nearly accomplished on schedule. The enrollment rose by more than 27%, and first-year enrollment is expected to reach the 30% goal by 2017-2018. The AAMC executive vice president told us that medical school growth wasn't the problem in meeting the doctor shortage. Instead, he pointed to the lack of residency positions at teaching hospitals. The Balanced Budget Act of 1997 set caps on the number of residency positions that the federal government funds. The AAMC has been lobbying Congress ever since to raise them. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Stanford-based bioengineer Manu Prakash has a simple goal. He wants to create a portable medical lab small enough to fit in a backpack, and he's already developed a tool that fits the bill. While sitting under a tree in Uganda, he noticed that the local medical clinic's door was propped open by an expensive centrifuge machine, one that was reliant on electricity, now broken and no longer in use. And he wondered, how could he create a portable centrifuge that would be inexpensive to make, easy to operate, and easy to replace? His inspiration came from a simple ancient childhood toy, the whirligig, a toy that functions by pulling two ends of a string threaded through a round object like a button.
Before us, nobody had actually understood how this toy works. So we spent a significant portion of this time truly understanding the mathematical phase space for how you can convert linear motion into rotational motion. And there's some beautiful mathematics hidden inside this object.
So he took this simple toy idea to another level, creating a human-powered centrifuge made from simple components. Paper, twine, and plastic. Altogether, each paperfuge, as he calls it, can be constructed in under 2 minutes and costs only 20 cents. And yet, remarkably, it works extremely efficiently.
With this set of principles, we're able to essentially make a centrifuge that spins all the way to 120,000 RPM. In the lab, we can separate and pull out malaria parasites from blood. We can separate filaria, African sleeping sickness, separate blood plasma. It is an ultra-low-cost centrifuge that's built out of principles of a very old toy.
Prakash and his team have already deployed the paperfuge to a couple of third-world clinical settings to start collecting data for wider deployment. It's currently being tested for malaria diagnoses, but is being readied for far more complex diagnostic challenges.
This is a tool that requires no electricity, no infrastructure. You can carry them around in your pockets for a price point of 20 cents.
The paperfuge.
A cheap but highly effective field tool for clinicians, providing a portable solution to diagnostic challenges, creating a quicker pathway to diagnosis and treatment. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.